This and other podcasts are available on the Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
What up, everybody? This is Spencer, and you are listening to my dad and his Handgun World podcast. The reason he carries a gun is because he can't carry a cop.
Hi folks, Bob Main here with another episode of the Handgun World podcast. The reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. Welcome to episode number 232. This week I want to answer some listener voicemails, some real good ones that have come to me lately. And I also have Ben Branham, who has recorded a podcast that is very informative on the .40 caliber Smith & Wesson cartridge. Now, there was no middle of the week show. I guess I got really busy this week. I just swamped, just really packed. And Ben sent me this, but I figured, hey, it was so good that it was going to kind of tie into some of the voicemail discussion that I just put it at the end of the regular weekly episode. So, sorry there was no middle of the week show. That's probably not going to be an every week thing, but most of the time. So, that's going to be coming up at the end, Ben talking about the .40 caliber. So, let's get into some voicemails here. There were some real good ones. All kinds of different topics have come. So let's see here. By the way, I'm in the Handgun World mobile studio. I'm driving. I want you to know that I've listened to these voicemails twice before I left on my trip. So I know what they're going to say, and I've pretty much committed most of them to memory, and I've pretty much got my answers all planned out and everything. I wrote down some of my answers or some notes to myself on paper before I left. So just so you don't think that I'm actually listening to this and trying to podcast and everything while I'm driving and and doing all that stuff. I mean, I am talking to you while I'm driving, but that's it. I've got everything, all my responses here planned out. Okay, let's go to the first one, I believe, is George.
Hi, Bob. This is George from Virginia calling about ammo. I wanted to follow up from your podcast and say that here in May in Virginia, the situation with ammo is getting better. There is ammo available. Not every store every week has everything, but with a little effort, everything is available at reasonable prices if you look around. Two things, though, that I have seen in the past month that are perhaps a, you know, indication of a problem is, one, I was in a store and there was a guy purchasing .40 caliber ammunition, and he didn't even own a .40 caliber. And that's what they had available, and he was buying all he could. And I said, why are you buying it if you don't have the gun? And he said, I'm using it to trade when, you know, the stink hits the fan. So I guess that's certainly his right to do so, but doesn't help supplies if people are hoarding ammo for weapons they don't even own. And then the other thing was a gentleman at Walmart yelling at the clerk. They didn't have too much ammunition. They did have double-buck shotgun shells, which I was purchasing, because I have a tactical 12 gauge for home defense, and that's a good choice. And this guy was yelling at the clerk because she didn't have cheap 9mm ammo. And I said, well, you know, geez, there's 9mm ammo on the other side of town at such and such a store. And he said, well, I'm not paying anything more than $12 for a box of 50. And I said, well, good luck in 2013 finding that. And then he said, well, I only have 12,000 rounds at home. And I said, well, gee, you're going to have to either shoot less or spend more to maintain that supply. So certainly 12,000 rounds seems like enough to me. Anyway, I just thought I'd give you a little anecdotes from the field that the ammo situation is better than it was back in the winter. Certainly not back to normal, but I think on the upswing. Thank you.
I wish I had 12,000 rounds of 9mm at home. Wow, 12,000 rounds, and the guy is acting like he's hard up for ammunition? Yeah, I would kind of agree with you on that one, George. I think the guy either needs to maybe shoot a little bit less or get into reloading or something like that. Now, the first part of your voicemail there, the guy buying ammunition for a gun he doesn't even own. You know, I've been heavily criticized for suggesting that on this podcast and the other podcast that I do. Matter of fact, Trapper Brad on iTunes he gave me a rotten iTunes review saying that I'm part of the problem and that I'm a fearmonger. So you might want to go over to iTunes and check that out. Trapper Brad thinks that I am part of the problem. And so he gave me this very negative review because he says I'm trying to scare people to death for suggesting that you buy ammunition for a gun that you don't even own. Well, George, first of all, that guy doing that is probably not the reason we have an ammo shortage. I don't think that this happens on a great scale, okay? And when I suggest that, I'm talking about a couple of boxes, at the most, a couple of boxes. You know, it might be good bartering material later on down the road. Maybe. I'm not saying go buy 3,000 rounds for a caliber that you don't own. I'm just saying a couple boxes might not be a bad idea. And if you don't even want to do that, okay, that's fine. It was just a suggestion. But George, you know, it's good news that the ammo is becoming more available again. That's good. I don't think that that's what's contributing to the ammo shortage. I think what's contributing to the ammo shortage is a couple of major things. Number one, because the politicians have scared everybody so much, everybody's going out and buying guns and ammo for the first time. They're first-timers by the millions. And so when you got millions and millions of first-time gun buyers and first-time gun owners, because they're scared that they may not be able to get these again, that is a major contributor to the ammo shortage. The government is contributing to the ammo shortage. What about the Department of Homeland Security buying, you know, hundreds of millions or billions of rounds? You know, could that be contributing to the ammo shortage? So I think that's the major contributors. I don't think it's some guy out there probably buying a couple of boxes of 40 caliber, even though he doesn't own a 40 caliber. But it's good points that you bring up. And George, I'm glad you're finding that the ammo is starting to normalize a little bit. We're not back to mid-2012 prices. Matter of fact, we may never get back to those kinds of prices. Folks, we may never get back to $9 a box for 9mm. When I started shooting in 2005, sometimes Academy Sports and Outdoors would run CCI Blazer 9mm 115 grain full metal jacket on sale for like $4.98 a box of 50. $4.98. Well, those days went away quickly. Then I started thinking that $9.98 was a good price. Those days are gone. It's kind of like gas prices, isn't it? I remember when I first started driving, gas was around 30 cents or 40 cents a gallon. You know, I'm 51 years old. I started driving in the 70s. How many of you remember gas wars? How many of you remember when gas stations had gas wars, pricing wars, and the prices would drop down to like, you know, 20, 30 cents a gallon, even 40 cents a gallon in some places? We're never going to see any of that kind of stuff again. I don't think we're ever going to see below $3 a gallon, or at least we're not going to see below $2.50. So ammo prices are kind of the same way. So it's not getting back to normal, but I'm glad to see that ammo is becoming more available, and I'm glad that ammo is starting to go down in price. That's a real good thing. So George, thanks for sharing that that voicemail. He's got another one that he called in a couple of days later. So here's George again.
Hi, Bob. This is George from Virginia calling. And I wanted to comment on your podcast from mid last week rifles versus handguns with a guest speaker. In it, he was talking about using a rifle to defend yourself at ranges of 100, 200, or 300 yards. And that kind of made me wonder what he was getting at, because I'm not aware of too many personal defense or home defense instances, you know, where you could say I needed to shoot someone who was 100, 200, or 300 yards away with a rifle. And I think, you know, that was just a little bit on the I'm not sure what the word is, but a little bit on the careless side from a bunch of reasons, legally perhaps being one of them. So maybe on the southwest border where you have a big ranch, there's somebody coming at you and shooting at you from hundreds of yards away, causing you to have to defend yourself, but I'm not aware of too many cases of that. So certainly I would urge you or perhaps another one of your guest speakers who knows more about it than I do to comment on using a rifle for defending yourself at ranges such as 200 yards away and what that means in terms of legal standing. Anyway, just a thought, it made me think. Keep up the good work. Thank you very much.
What George is talking about is Ben Branham's Middle of the Week show he did a while back, where he was talking about the differences between rifles and pistols for self-defense. George, I'll say this. What you're probably thinking is that probably sounds a little tinfoil hat-ish, right? Having to shoot somebody at 200 or 300 yards with a rifle. You remember when John Hadaway and I were doing an interview not too long ago, and John said, let's remember the difference between possible and probable. In other words, what's possible and then what's really probable? Okay, is it possible that we might have to use our rifle at 200 yards in self-defense? I'd have to say yes. Is it probable? No. For a civilian, that is. Now, I'm not talking about military. Whole different story there. Yes, military may have to shoot at 200 meters. For a civilian, is that probable? No. Is it advisable? Probably not, because I would agree that at 200 yards, that would look more offensive than defensive. I mean, if I've got a bad guy 200 yards from me, I think I have plenty of opportunity to get away, unless he's firing upon me. Now, even if he's firing at me from 200 yards, if I'm not hit, there may be a pretty good chance that I can find some cover or concealment, or at least be able to get out of the way. Then again, maybe not. It all depends. Are we talking wide open spaces? Some of you who live in desert areas, are we talking about that somebody could be, they could be out in the desert 200 yards away from you firing at you? That's possible. It's probably not the likeliest of scenarios, but it's possible. Yeah, down here in South Texas, down by the border. You know, you got to remember what Ben does. Ben works in a lot of the oil fields and a lot of the oil rigs down here in South Texas, out there in no man's land. And some of the places he travels to are pretty close to the border. Some of you listening to this might be living in desert areas. I don't know. So let's remember possible versus probable. It's probably not very likely or advisable, but it is possible, maybe. So practice with your rifle at 200 yards. What does it hurt? Now, I look at rifles and shotguns as 50-yard weapons. That's what I look at them at. And that's how I practice. I practice as if they're a 50-yard weapon, 100 yards at the most. So all I'm looking for is good accuracy, good control, and a decent rate of fire, and train myself to use that long gun at 50 to 100 yards. Because to me, that's more likely the distance that I would see myself having to use a long gun. And my long guns serve a specific purpose. Their purpose is when I need more stopping power and more capacity than my pistol. All right, once again, when I need more stopping power and more capacity than my pistol. and when I need more range, slightly more range. That's what my long guns do. That's the niche that they fill. I've always kind of wondered why people focus so much on rifles that shoot at 300, 400 meters. Civilians, anyway. Because I've kind of thought like George, when are you going to do that? When are you going to fire that gun in self-defense at 200 or 300 or 400 meters? It's not very likely. So I would not suggest, if I were you, spend a huge amount of time training yourself at that distance. I would spend most of your time training at 50 to 125 yards, let's say. Of course, it could depend on where you live. If you live out in the country, then 300 or 400 yards might be viable. If you're like me and you live in the suburbs, in the suburbs where I live, I can't see anywhere where I'd be taking a shot at 200 meters or 200 yards. I don't see it. Not in the neighborhood and the general area that I live in. So, George, you bring up a good point. I'll let Ben respond to it if he wants. I thought it was a good point that Ben brought up in the podcast. I really did. I thought it was a good point that you really should be able to be accurate and make hits at a couple hundred yards just in case. So that's kind of the way that I'll leave it at that. If anybody else has some more insight on this or has more comments on this particular subject, my voicemail number is 210-646-1727, 210-646-1727, or just go to handgunworld.com and there's a call me button over in the margin on the lower right side. Just press call me and my website will do the rest. It'll connect your phone with my voicemail and you can leave a message that way. Okay, let's move on to the next voicemail.
Hey, Bob. This is Dan Vamos from Homestead Dividends. How you doing? Listen, the reason I'm calling is twofold. One, a review, and second is how that review kind of ties into my own personal defense. And here's the situation. My wife has a Sig Sauer 380 Auto, model 230, and she's comfortable with the pistol or has spoken highly of it. I never shot it before. And although I had some other pistols for self-defense, it was kind of the one that I was planning on just using as our default protective weapon in the easy-to-get-to place, you know, the secure place for emergencies. And I did that without even firing the gun. I was considering it. Well, I took the gun to the range and was very, very disappointed with it. I'm not here to bash the gun. I'm here to make the point that don't just assume that the gun's going to work for you if you don't fire it. You got to take the time to actually, you know, practice with a weapon and see if it's really a good fit for you. For instance, she bought the gun, 10 years ago before we got married, and I took it out to the range just recently. After about 30 rounds or so, the screw for the grips fell out. I found it and put it back in, which is not that big of a deal. But I got fail to feed after fail to feed after fail to feed after fail to eject. And after kind of field stripping it there and cleaning it right there on the spot, I kept getting all these problems with the gun. And the point I'm making here, I guess, is on one hand, you just can't assume that the gun, because of a reputation like a Sig Sauer, is going to be right or operates well or whatever. I'm going to rely on my Glock 17. I've never had an issue with it, except for one time limp wristing it. And, you know, that's my fault for just not having a good grip on it. But it's been completely reliable. Sig, not so much. So while my wife might want to use that as a backup pistol for self-defense, I'm not comfortable with it, and it's not going in the easy-to-open safe for, you know, emergency. And to that extent, you know, just a quick review of the Sig 230. I didn't like the fact that the magazine ejectors on the absolute bottom of the gun, on the, you know, on the handle underneath. It makes it very difficult to release the mag. You know, I was very uncomfortable with all the failed feeds. And, you know, even though a gun has a great reputation, you just can't go by the reputation. And even though that model might be good, the one that my wife has, I consider a lemon. Now, she's not had problems with her. She speaks highly of it, but I can't. And so you know, I just wanted to throw out that review that you just can't, just because it says Glock or just because it says SIG or just because it says High Point, you can't, you know, gauge accurately, in my opinion, the quality of a weapon. So to that extent, I give a thumbs down to the 6-hour 230 semi-auto
Thanks, Dan. How are you? Hey, just a quick shout-out. Dan does the Homestead Dividends podcast. It's an excellent prepper podcast. You might want to check it out. Dan, thanks for the review on the SIG 230 380 caliber handgun. I'll just say this. Don't judge the entire SIG line based on the bad functionality of one gun. SIG makes fine weapons. And every other SIG that I've ever owned or shot has been a good gun. So that 230 might not be very good for you, and I'm sorry to hear that. I don't like some of the designs of some of those European-style guns, especially with the mag release at the bottom of the grip like that. I agree with you. But don't judge the entire SIG line just by that. And by the way, since he brought up 380 caliber handguns, I need to clear something up from last week's caliber discussion. When I was talking about 9x19 and 9x18 and 9x17 millimeter rounds, I got something wrong. The case size is what that's referring to. So in other words, a 9 millimeter round is, the case is 9x19. It's 9 millimeters diameter, 19 millimeters long. And that's why the 380 is shorter. It's 9x17. So again, I got that wrong. I was telling you that it was the overall round length. It's actually the length of the actual case. And Magnum also, Magnum refers to the fact that it's got more powder in it, and it's loaded at higher pressures and going at higher velocities. That's why some people call the 357 SIG a 9mm Magnum. Because a 357 SIG is essentially in a 40 caliber case. And more powder, more pressure, faster moving bullet, but it's still a 9mm bullet. And 40 caliber refers to 0.40 inches. 45 caliber refers to inches. So a 45 is 0.45 inches, or also 11 millimeters. Okay? So, anyway, I wanted to correct that from last week, but sorry to get a little off track here on Dan's voicemail. Sorry to hear that about the SIG P230. But, you know, thanks for sharing that honest review of the gun. Have you tried sending that back to SIG and asking them to make it right? I would do that. You know, you probably paid a good amount of money for that gun, and your wife, if she's going to use that, rely on that gun for self-defense, send it back to SIG. Have them make it right. Okay, Dan, thanks again. Let's go to the next voicemail.
Hey, Bob, this is Damian from Dallas, and I just wanted to comment on MST23 with Ben Branham on 10 signs you carry that you carry a gun. Excellent podcast, but I'll apologize up front. This may take a couple of phone calls for me to get through, but I was listening to that, and I agree with everything Ben said, but I think the podcast should be called 10 Signs You're Carrying a Gun at 3:30 position, because most of the things that were mentioned, in my opinion, appendix carry eliminates. Number one, tugging over your garment over the gun when you have a when you carry appendix, and I do carry a Glock 26 Gen 4 subcompact, even though I do also carry my Glock 19 appendix, but the Glock 26 is more comfortable. But tugging over your garment when you're carrying appendix at the 2 o'clock position is something that you don't do, because you have the gun in front of you, and the shirt hangs more on your front than it does in the back. Number two, you protect the one side of your body, not with appendix carry, because unless you're running into a wall face first, you're not worried about any one side of your body brushing up against any furniture or a wall. Number three, one side sagging more than the other. Since the gun is at a 2 o'clock position, the sagging occurs in the front of your pants, keeping the rest of your pants on the left and right even. So, and it doesn't really sag that much because you're carrying, I'll carry a subcompact anyway, but there's less issues with that. Number four, pull up your pants when you get up to adjust the gun. Again, with appendix carry, when I sit down, I can adjust. What I do is I sit down, I adjust my 2 o'clock position, I slide it over to 1 o'clock when I'm eating at a restaurant, and before I get up, I can easily slide the appendix carrier to 2 o'clock position and even, you know, pad my shirt and just kind of make sure everything's good to go before I even get up. Number 4, when you sit down, the gun hits chair booth, not so with appendix carrying. Number 6, constantly checking to make sure it's there. You don't do that because it's in front of your crotch. I mean, you know it's there. Number 7, walking weird with the sway, with your arm out further on the gun side, not a problem with appendix carry. Talking about it in public, I'm guilty. I do that with friends and probably talk louder than I should, so a great point there. Bend over funny. You still bend over funny with appendix carry, but I found that if I have my subcontact, I can literally bend down normal. You know, at some level, it'll hurt a little bit, the gun will poke at you. But if I'm carrying my 19, I do still have to bend over a little funny. But when I carry my 26, not so much, is a big problem. And number 10, holding your shirt down when you reach for things. Also not a big problem with appendix carry, because what normally happens when you reach up is the back of your shirt that lifts up, not the front. So again, I think 10 great points, but I think if you carry appendix, and there's a lot of other advantages, I believe, tactically, why I prefer appendix. Hey, Bob, this is Damian Pace, too, real quick. I did get through my 10 points with appendix carry, but I was about to say that there's other reasons why I prefer appendix carry over 330, even though I do have a 330 or an MTAC Minotaur, and I do carry in that position. I carry appendix probably 95% of the time. And now I can carry my 26 the most. But one of the things about appendix carry, and it is what it is, you got to lose that belly. Appendix carry is extremely comfortable to the point where I almost forget I have something there, but it's not so comfortable if you got a big gut in the way. So you do gotta, you know, kind of get that belly out of the way, and appendix carry becomes a very viable option. Another thing I like about appendix carry is I'm walking down an alley, or I'm sitting down an alley, yeah, like I'm gonna be in an alley. I'm walking down the parking lot at Walmart a little late at night, and I see somebody that looks suspicious, you know, walking in the same direction I am. With appendix carry, I have my hand right where my gun is and look absolutely normal because I'm not reaching back at the 330 position or getting my hand close to that position just in case something happens. I can walk easily with my hand in front of me like you normally would, and have literally my thumb underneath my grip, and nobody would know the wiser. Also, if you get in a confrontation and you get knocked down in a fight, you always know that you don't want to land face first. You want to land on your back so you can lift your legs, arms, and defend yourself. Well, with appendix carry, the gun is on top where you need it, where you can grab it easily or easier to turn it and take a close shot. And those are just a couple examples. There's a lot of reasons why I prefer appendix carry. But just wanted to say the 10 signs are all true, but appendix carry does eliminate most of them. So great podcast, and you guys do an awesome job. Take care.
Well, Damian, you bring up some good points. I didn't think about that. So thanks for calling in that voicemail. Yeah, what Ben was talking about in the middle of the week episode called 10 Signs That Say You're Carrying a Gun. I came up with that title, by the way, the 10 signs that tip people off that you're carrying a gun. A lot of those do go away when you're appendix carrying. This is why I'm such a huge believer in appendix carry. I can conceal a gun easier, the same size gun, easier in the appendix carry position. And you get used to it, folks. You just do. And with the right kind of holster specifically designed for appendix carry, it works. I'll talk about some holsters that I like for appendix carry here in just a minute. So, Damian brings up some pretty good points. It does kind of make a big difference. Now, let's talk about some holsters and guns. First of all, I'll put a disclaimer on this, that some of you, due to body shape, might not be able to appendix carry. I get that. I've lost 13 pounds in the last about 5 weeks. I plan on losing another 10. I don't have a real big midsection, so appendix carry works pretty well. I don't normally appendix carry my Glock 19. Sometimes I do, but not normally. Normally I appendix carry my Smith & Wesson M&P Shield or my Car Arms PM9, something like that. Although I appendix carried my Glock 19 last Tuesday, I think it was. So, holsters that I like. Believe it or not, the Al-Kydex Dale Fricke Archangel holster is terrific. Mine's made for a Glock 26, but I put my Glock 19 in it. The way Dale's designed that is really, really good. And yes, it's comfortable, folks, even sitting down and driving. Now, if you carry a Glock 26 in that, it's a dream. I mean, it really works great. If you want even a little bit more comfort, I like Remora holsters. I really do. I like Remora holsters. Three of them were given to me as a gift by one of the guys that came through a training class that I recently helped John Payne teach close-range gunfighting. So, Chris, thank you for giving me those Remora holsters. I appreciate that. I don't know if he wants me to give out his last name, but I appreciate you very much giving me these holsters. I use them all the time. That was a very nice gift, very nice, generous gift for you to give me these. He gave me three Remora holsters. He gave me the type that have the stiff opening of the holster. The top of the holster is stiff. They actually do stay open when you take the pistol out, but the bottom of the holster is soft and it flexes, so it increases comfort. And I use those for appendix carry, and they're fast draw and they stay in place, and they're really cool. They're holsters that don't have a clip, and they don't need one because they stay in place because of the material and the tension of your belt. Now, it's important to always have a good belt. And you know, I'm a big fan of sturdy belts, and I'm a big fan of the Wilderness Tactical Frequent Flyer belt, and I'm a real big fan of the Python gun belt that Jason Christensen makes at Concealment Solutions. All very nice belts. I'm wearing my sturdy belt today because I've been doing business all day, and it's just a better looking belt for business. One appointment I had to tuck my shirt in, so I slid my 380 in my pocket. And then after I was finished up with my business today on the drive home, I untucked the shirt. And now I got my Glock 19. But it was nice having that sturdy belt because it looks just like a business belt, but it's a gun belt. And I'm still using the sturdy belt to support my Glock 19, which is riding in my Concealment Solutions Black Mamba. As far as appendix carry, Jason makes a pretty good appendix carry rig. Jason Christensen, Concealment Solutions. I think he calls it the ASP. Appendix specific platform or something like that. Check that out. So between Dale Fricke, Concealment Solutions, Remora, you can even get the Dale Fricke Zack holster, which is just that little holster that covers the trigger guard, and then it's got a little piece of paracord that you loop to a belt loop, for example. And of course, the little plastic piece that completely covers the trigger guard makes it impossible for the gun to fire. But as soon as you draw it, shortly after you draw it, it's going to pop off that trigger guard and your gun's ready to use. That makes it real comfortable to appendix carry just about any kind of a pistol. So, Damien, I'm glad that you switched over to it. You know, some people think appendix carry is dangerous. Some podcasters have even created entire podcasts to talk about how dangerous appendix carry is and how you shouldn't do it. I disagree. I take a different approach. There are many, many advantages to appendix carry. And if you practice and train and you have good trigger finger discipline, you're going to be okay. Go to my YouTube channel. Oh, you know what? No, that's not on YouTube. I did it on the Shooters Club. Well, for all of you who listen to this show and you're a member of my Shooters Club, there's a video. I did a video on how to make appendix carry safe and how to make your draw safe from appendix carry. How to make it very, very safe. It's on there. It's on the Shooters Club. I think it's called Appendix Carry Safe and Effective. A lot of trainers, a lot of really top-notch, well-respected trainers appendix carry themselves and teach appendix carry. And you know, that's one thing I like about the Zach holster, the one that just covers the trigger guard. That's sold also through One Source Tactical through Suarez International's gear website. The thing I like about that is if you carry a gun appendix carry with that Zach holster, that gun has cleared your belt. The muzzle has cleared your belt and it's already starting to point towards the target by the time that holster pops off the trigger guard. Or at least you can set it up that way. So if you're really concerned about safety, if you happen to accidentally let your booger hook touch the bang switch when it's not supposed to, with that Zach holster, by the time you do that, that gun's not going to be pointing down at the private parts or the femoral artery. It's going to be way past all that stuff if you should happen to accidentally fire it. That is, if you don't have good trigger finger discipline. I might make a video and prove that to you. So, and that one I'll put on my general free YouTube channel. So, all right, Damien, thanks again for that clarification. I appreciate that.
Good afternoon, Bob. My name's Tom Stewart. I'm calling from Roanoke, Virginia. I've enjoyed your show for several years now. I'm just calling to say that I'm keeping you and your family, and especially your wife, in my prayers and my thoughts. There's thousands of us out here, and we don't all get a chance to participate like we could, but you're well thought of by many, many people, and I hope everything goes as well as can be expected. Take care, buddy, and God bless you. Bye.
Thank you, Tom. That means a lot. You know, folks, I have received just a tremendous amount of support from many of you who listen. I've received it, emails. I've received voicemails like Tom just called in, Facebook messages, and I really much appreciate that. I can't tell you how much that helps me out, folks. It really does. You're making a difference. A lot of people say to me, well, Bob, you make a difference. You know, you help us out. You know, some of you listen to both of the podcasts that I do. You listen to today's survival show, and you listen to this one, the Handgun World podcast. And it's heartwarming to me to know that I'm making a difference. I just share my experiences with you folks, and if that makes a difference, that's great. I'm flattered by that, and I'm also humbled by that. I appreciate that. It is a tough time. Things even got tougher today. I'm not going to get into that right now, but things got tougher today. But I'm still trying to keep my chin up, and I had work to do today. I'm recording this on the Friday before the Memorial Day weekend. I hope you guys have a good Memorial Day weekend. Some of you might listen to this after the weekend's over. I get that. If some of you are listening to it, it normally comes out. My shows normally come out Sunday afternoon, normally like somewhere around 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon is typically when I release them. And if you're listening to it right away, I hope you have a good rest of the Memorial Day weekend. Many thanks to all of you veterans out there. Many thanks to you for the service that you give to us to keep this great country going, this great country where we can have the freedom to carry guns and do podcasts and write blogs and say and do things that we can do where you just can't do this in a lot of countries, folks. You just can't. So I'm blessed that I have this opportunity that I can sit in my 12-year-old Honda Accord on a business trip and yak at you and do a podcast. I mean, how cool is that? I never forget the freedom that enables me to do this. And you soldiers who have worn the uniform of the United States of America and those who have paid the ultimate price and gave their lives, I appreciate that. I did not serve, and I sort of regret that I did not serve. So I sort of treat this podcast as my way of serving, okay? But many thanks as we spend this Memorial Day remembering the veterans. All right, let's take a quick break, and then we'll get Ben Branham on here. It's not an interview. This is a pre-recorded podcast that he did about the 40 Smith & Wesson cartridge. Stay tuned.
A woman is approximately 10 times more likely to be successfully raped when she doesn't have a gun, according to a Department of Justice study. This explains why women in the United States use firearms about 200,000 times a year to stop sexual assaults. It also explains why more than 40% of women own or already have access to a firearm. So why do some politicians want to disarm women? Maybe rape isn't a serious enough crime in their minds. Or maybe they don't want to stare down the wrong end of your barrel.
Arm yourself with facts to strip the gun control industry bare. Visit gunfacts.info and get your free copy of Gun Facts. Called Indispensable by Cam Edwards of NRA News, Gun Facts is your rapid reference guide to debunking gun control myths and shaming politicians into obedience. www.gunfacts.info.
Okay, before I bring Ben on here to talk about the 40 caliber, don't forget about the Shooters Club podcast. There's not much time. June 1st is going to be our first drawing. Ben just put up a new video on basically on room clearing, how to clear a house. It's pretty good. I like it. And with a handgun, he demonstrates it. He demonstrated it at one of the classes that we did, one of the Beyond Concealed Carry classes that he and I teach together. Pretty good stuff. So if you're a member of our Shooters Club, you'll see that video. There's tons of videos on there, lots of good audio podcasts with big names in the industry. A lot of good benefit on that. And the giveaways on our Shooters Club podcast is huge. A huge list of giveaways. Check it out. Go to handgunworld.com, click the Shooters Club page, and you can read about it. Ben Branham is teaching a class on his own in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I want to say it's August 3rd and 4th. He's teaching Beyond Concealed Carry. I can't be there for that one. So Ben's going out to Albuquerque. You can find that on the webpage as well. We're already half full for our four-hour Skill Builder workshop. That's a four-hour class that Ben and I are teaching in San Antonio. We're going to work on reloads, clearing malfunctions, and a little bit of moving and shooting, and then we're going to have a fun steel challenge where we're going to shoot a bunch of steel and make a competition out of it. So you're going to love that. So it's about 2 or 2.5 hours of training and a couple of hours of excellent fun from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. July 13th in San Antonio. It's half full already. And by the way, we still have room. We still have room in our Beyond Concealed Carry Level 2 classes. One's in Dallas, one's in San Antonio. You'll see all that on the website. Go to handgunworld.com and there's information and sign-up links for all of those. And by the way, a lot of you have been supporting my show through Amazon. If you buy something through Amazon, use the link in my Amazon store. I'll get paid a small commission from Amazon, and if you're going to buy something anyway, please buy it through my link. You'll see the Amazon store and my Everyday Carry store on my website. I appreciate that very much. I don't have sponsors on this show that pay every month to be on the show, so that's how you support. Speaking of product manufacturers, Concealment Solutions and Sturdy Belt have contributed product for giveaways on the Shooters Club drawing. So many thanks to Concealment Solutions. You get a holster of your choice. There'll be one winner of a holster of their choice from Concealment Solutions. And at Sturdy Belt, David Scaife is giving away a belt. So you'll get a free belt from sturdybelt.com. And Devin at White Dog Holsters. I think they're fantastic outside the waistband, Kydex. I like his holsters. They stay close to the body. They're a fast draw. That's all I compete with, and that's all I train with if I want to train outside the waistband. He's also contributed a holster. So giving away three holsters, some ammo, some training classes. Woo! Giving away a lot of good stuff to people who sign up for the Shooters Club. This includes everybody who's already signed up. Your name's going to go in the drawing, too. So continuing benefits other than just the content that we put up there. So many thanks to ConcealmentSolutions.com and SturdyBelt.com. All right, here you go. Ben Branham talks about the 40 Smith & Wesson cartridge.
Hello, and welcome to the Handgun World Podcast. I'll be your host today, Ben Branham. This is normally Bob Main's show, but every once in a while I get to do a little middle-of-the-week episode, and I'm glad to be with you. I carry a handgun because, like Bob, I can't carry a cop. And really, that's more of a metaphor for that I am responsible for me. Cops aren't just going to do it, and honestly, they just can't. They'd like to, but you can't be everywhere all the time. So today, I thought I'd get on here and talk to you a little bit about the 40 Smith & Wesson caliber. Bob talked a couple weeks ago or a little while ago about different cartridges and what they mean and where they come from and kind of what it means to be a beginner's look at some of this stuff. So I thought I'd dig a little deeper in the 40 Smith & Wesson. Gotta love that cartridge. No, I'm not really. If you guys know me and you've shot with me or anything, you know I shoot a 9mm and I shoot a 9mm for, well, two reasons. One, it's lighter. And two, it's cheaper. That is the dead giveaway of all of it. This cartridge, I don't know, this argument has been going on for forever, ever since somebody invented a second handgun cartridge in probably the 18-something, probably 1805 or 1810 or something. We've always been arguing about which one is better. And, you know, we've been fighting the 9mm against the 45 since, the 9mm came out. And now we're fighting the 9mm versus the 40 versus the 45 since the 40 came out. And you can add all these other ones. But I thought I'd give you a little bit of history behind the 40 Smith & Wesson cartridge. It kind of started life as a 10mm. And you have to go back and look at the Dade County shooting back in 1986. Right in there. Late 80s. The FBI had the big shootout with Platt and Maddox, and they lost some agents, and some agents turned into very heroic people, did some amazing things to end that fight and to win that fight. And we learned, I mean, that was one of the gunfights that you could learn a ton from studying. So if you ever want to just look up that in Wikipedia or something and just read about that fight, and you can find out a lot of stuff we learned about modern handgun and just modern fighting now. Has come from what we learned in that fight because things went really, really wrong for those six FBI agents that tried to take on two bank robbers that were hell-bent on murdering the world. Anyways, one of the things the FBI found was that their handgun ammunition failed miserably, and they were carrying a variety of things during that fight, 38s, 9mm, and I forget, one of the guys might have had a 45, but I forget. Either way, all their handguns utterly failed them. The ammo did not perform like they wanted it to. And looking back at all the autopsies and stuff, it miserably failed them. Some of them did the right things. I mean, Platt, the driver, had a Mini 14. I think it was Platt. Don't quote me on the names, but the ME looked at it and said that he had a fatal gunshot wound. Like one of the first shots was fatal. The guy was dead and just didn't know it. But he went on to murder two or three FBI agents after he was already dead. Handgun ammo not really helping you if the guy is dead and not stopping, right? So out of that came the FBI's test protocol. And they looked at all this stuff, and kind of the FBI started shooting all this stuff into ballistic gelatin, through walls, through window glass, through car doors, and through heavy clothing to discover what a bullet actually does when it hits something. And then they came up with, it's got to have this much expansion, it's got to have this much weight retention and this much penetration through the gel after going through stuff. And they kind of came up with a 38 plus P, 158 grain, semi-wad cutter. I think it was a jack hollow point. It was a lead, though, all lead. I have some here somewhere. Yeah, I'm looking at my gun shelf right now. I still have some 38 special plus Ps, 158 grain, semi-wad cutter, hollow points. And it's the old FBI load. And they came up with that was the minimum standard that they needed all their guys to carry. Well, one of the guys that was really smart there is, you know, started looking at 9mm and 45s. And then he had a 10mm, which was really, really an oddball cartridge at the time. Pulled it out and fired away and found out that, hey, the 10mm that will actually work. So Wikipedia said a little different because I did a little bit digging for this. But I remember the FBI going to Smith & Wesson and getting a Smith & Wesson, like, I think it was a 4020 or something. But in the day, you know, that was 1990, they got an autoloader that carried the 10 millimeter, and they started issuing it to their agents. And they found out that their agents really can't handle the 10 millimeter. A 10 millimeter is a pretty heavy recoiling round, and it's the cartridge itself is longer than a 9 millimeter or a 40. It's in the 45 length, so you have to have a large frame to handle that. So they're running this Smith & Wesson. If you've seen any of the old Smith & Wesson autoloaders, you know that, I mean, they dang things went bang every time, but they handled like a brick, and they were about the same weight as a brick. And the triggers weren't that great. They were manageable pistols for the time, and not bad for the time, actually. Now we have better stuff 20 years later. But so they started issuing these things to their agents, and they discovered that, look, our agents can't handle this recoil. They can't hide the bigger guns. They can't carry the bigger guns. Some of the smaller agents can't even hold the stinking things. They're so big. So back to the drawing board. And then Smith & Wesson kind of got with them, and they decided that, hey, if we do a reduced load in the 10 millimeter, that our agents will be able to shoot it better. But also, if we don't put all the powder and fill all that space in the cartridge, now we can cut down the cartridge. And so that's what they did. They took the 10 millimeter, cut it down so it's smaller, and now it will fit in the same size gun as a 9 millimeter because the cartridge length is the same. You gotta remember that, you know, physics dominates all these games we play, and a 45 is longer than a 9 millimeter. I don't care what company or who tells you what, a 45 gun will always be bigger than a 9 millimeter because the 9 millimeter cartridge is shorter and smaller. So they went to this 40 and they looked at that and they go, well, you know, if we just cut out that extra space, we can leave the same air volume pocket in there with the same amount of powder and push this thing out at like 1100 feet per second or so, and we can still make the FBI's minimum standards on it. So they started working on that, and ironies of ironies, Glock in 1990 came out with the Glock 40 before Smith & Wesson could come out with their 4022 Smith & Wesson. I think it was a 4022. Either way, and another ginormous gun. So you can see why, you know, when you think about the day, you look at a Glock versus one of these old Smith & Wessons they don't even make anymore because they're like a brick, and you can see why Glock got so popular so fast. So anyways, then you had Glocks come out, and then, you know, that's when law enforcement really started taking off on this 40, is in, they started changing those over, and then they started getting all this other stuff, and you have law enforcement changing over to the 40. And the 40 wasn't without its growing pains. I mean, everything hurts when it comes out new, right? 40 was the same thing. They had some issues, especially the Glocks with an unsupported chamber, firing out of battery, case failures. What was it, 96, give or take, that Federal went back and kind of redesigned the case a little bit to make sure that they wouldn't get those case blowouts. Because you're talking about, well, it's the same pressure as a 9mm, technically, 35,000 PSI in the chamber. But it was a little different because the round is bigger. So it changed things some. And then for some reason, the Glock didn't, 9mm Glock and then 40 Glock didn't transfer straight over. They had some case blowouts. And so you'll still find that from time to time, especially if you're using some older ammo in your 40. You might have a case failure and a case side rupture out the bottom where your chamber isn't fully supported. And most guns do not have a fully supported chamber. The part that's not supported is the bottom on the feed ramp where the round slides up into the chamber to actually fire. Glock was notorious for this when it first came out, that they would do that. And also, Glock, knuckleheads, they might have ran this into production a little bit fast. And so you had some problem with the first and second generation Glocks in 40, the ones without the dust cover and the light rail and without the finger grooves. Those are the first and second generations. And they would fire out a battery a little bit. You get the 40 going up in there, it wasn't quite all the way in battery, and so you had even more. And so you'd fire the gun, and it would fire out of battery, and then you'd have, depending on how far it was out of battery, you'd have all sorts of things like pressure going down into your magazine, blowing out magazines and stuff. To my knowledge, nobody really got seriously hurt by it. Glock has since fixed the problem, not that big a deal, but you did have some growing pains with the round. Well, after that, it's kind of this mystique around the 40 kept growing. And I say mystique because it really wasn't a mysterious thing. If you look at the invention of the round was in 1990 or so, and then Glock came out with their 40 in 1990, and Smith & Wesson came out with their 40, and everybody just started going higher and higher into this 40 realm. Well, about the same time is when bullet construction really started to take off. And you had, I mean, the first thing you had was those Black Talons, and everybody knows the mystique behind those. They were just the first thing to actually reliably expand. Everything else was just kind of junk out there that would expand sometimes, and other times it wouldn't. So you never knew what you were going to get when you're firing, expanding, you know, hollow point, the stuff that we think of today. And so as the 40 craze kind of grew and the 9mm kind of got a worse and worse rap, which it kind of deserved if you're only shooting 9mm full metal jacket, even if you're shooting the NATO plus P plus stuff or just plus P plus, they're not really helping you because they're zinging through things and they just weren't working. And then when bullet companies try to get cheap and you use the same bullet for your 38, your 357, and your 9mm, you know, those jack of all trades, master of none, kind of really got in there and they had all sorts of issues with the 9mm. And so nobody wanted to carry 9mm, everybody wanted a 45. Well, this 40 was coming on and on and on, and they were starting to have real-world shootings with it after it was carried for a while. And they were finding that the gun was performing, well, they thought it was the cartridge, the Smith & Wesson, 40 was performing outstanding. I mean, they were having shots, and yeah, unfortunately, they had to shoot bad guys, but it was to save the good guys. But the gun, it was working. It was working like they wanted it to. They had people going down. They didn't have to shoot them 25 times like with a 9mm. They shot them a couple times, and the guy went down and stayed down. And all of a sudden, this 40 mystique kept coming in. Well, it wasn't because the 40 round is so much greater than the 9mm or the 45, which some of the stats that I saw in the late 90s, early 2000s, actually showed that the 40 was having more success in real-world gun battles than the 45. And definitely the 9mm. But the problem is we didn't account for ammo. In the 40, you know, there wasn't, there, because it came out so late, there wasn't any really crappy designs going on, and there wasn't much else shooting that size bullet. I mean, you stuff the same bullet in a 40 and a 10mm, but not like the 9mm where you've got the 38 special little snub-nose J-frame, and then you've got a 357 Magnum, and you're trying to shove the same bullet in there, and just things don't work that way when you've got that extreme spread on speeds. And at the higher speeds, you know, a bullet needs to be constructed heavier, or not heavier, but more solid, like bonded and everything, or at, you know, 1,400, 1,500 feet per second of that 357 Magnum, it hits something and just rips that bullet apart. And then you're firing it out of a 38 Special J-frame, and it's only cooking out there at 800 feet per second. We're talking about this huge, huge spread of speed that this thing has to deal with. So 9mm bullets kind of lag behind. The 40, there was no bad rounds out there, so that the ammo just kept getting better and better. The hit ratios were getting better and better. Law enforcement was making hits with it. And the stats were showing that the 40 was doing really, really well. Officers could handle it because of the smaller frame, and it was still putting people down. Well, I think that was just as much to do with the ammo technology coming along and the bullet technology coming along as the 40 being anything to write home about. So that's kind of where it got its mystique of being this man stopper and everything else. But, you know, those mystiques are just like the 357 Magnum's mystique and the 44 Magnum. And, you know, some of those came from, well, the 44 Magnum came from the old Dirty Harry movies. But the 357, it was just so much better than the 38 and the way it worked. So it got that mystique. Same thing happened when we had all this crappy 9mm and people are shooting high points and, or not high points, I'm sorry, a P-35. Browning high power, not a high point, a Browning high power P-35. And, you know, they have 15 round magazines, but they were loading them with full metal jackets because they wouldn't, you know, that gun was designed, P-35, 1935, it was designed around a full metal jacket bullet. So it wasn't, it wouldn't feed reliably on the hollow points. So people kept stuffing full metal jackets in there, which, you know, a gun that goes bang is better than a gun that doesn't go bang. But either way, so then you got these high cap 9mm that just are not working to stop people, and the 40 is. So more and more departments went to the 40 Smith & Wesson, and now we have it as one of the most, probably is the most common caliber for law enforcement in all of America. But all that, I am not a fan of the 40 Smith & Wesson. I shoot a 9mm, told you in the beginning. I've shot a 45 in the past. Love that old big dumb round, the 45. And yes, it is a big dumb round because it does dumb things as moving out there to like 850, 900 feet per second. And it's a 230 grain bullet just trucking out there. It's kind of slow and but it hits things and does weird things like skids along the ground or traverses things or doesn't penetrate because it's such a big fat round. And then you have this 9mm zipping out there at like 1,200 feet per second, and it's hitting and it's doing crazy things like popping holes where it shouldn't be popping holes, where it should be stopping. So, you know, why is the 40? I don't like the 40 because it's a jack of all trades and the master of none. Really, we wanted the stopping power that the 45 gave over the 9mm at the time, but we wanted it in the size gun of a 9mm. We wanted something that, I mean, PR is PR. It keeps going more and more. We wanted female officers and FBI agents to be able to carry a bigger round than their hands would allow, and that the technology of the day would allow us to make guns around. I mean, now it's getting better and better with some of these plastics and other techniques, the CNC milling techniques and stuff. You can still get a smaller round, and you can still get a grip that's small enough for somebody with smaller hands to actually hold on to and shoot. AKA the Springfield XDS that's so popular right now. A really cool little gun. But just about everybody that picks it up can put their hands around it, and it feels really comfortable because it's so small and thin. So it is possible nowadays, but we still stick with the 40. And the problem with the 40 is going to be the extra recoil and the extra noise. It really is. It's a sharp recoil impulse because of the high pressures you're looking at. Inside the chamber, you're still pushing up to 35,000 PSI in there, and you're moving a 180 grain bullet out at give or take 1,100 feet per second or something like that. To give you an idea, the 9mm is moving that 125 grain bullet out there a little bit faster, but it's still running the 35,000 PSI. So we have the same kind of push behind the bullet, but we have a heavier bullet in the 40, so you're going to get a lot more recoil. And you say that about the 45 too, but the 45 is more of a push impulse instead of a smack because it has a lower pressure curve. The pressures are like 27,000 PSI on the 45. Either way, it's a lower pressure round, so you don't have that big spike and that big sharp recoil. You have more of a push in the 45. So the 40 does that. 40, because of the higher pressures and the bigger load, you're beating up the gun more, beating up the shooter more. And for me, I really got to bear down and grip on the gun, not to get it to stay, but to get it to not move so I can get faster follow-up shots. For me, the 9mm, I can torque my wrists and get it in there and lock down, thumbs forward, and shoot just fine and not have that gun barely move at all. With a 45, I can do the old school revolver and put the thumb on top of the thumb and shoot limp-wristed. And because of that light push and that big giant slide moving back and forth, I can get that thing to, it will go up kind of like a Dirty Harry shooting that 44 Magnum and go straight to the sky. But when that slide slaps forward, it pulls the whole gun back on target for me. It works really well. The 40, man, I really got to hold on to that thing to keep my hands locked together. I almost want to interlace my fingers to keep that thing from moving around on me so much. The gun just torques and moves, and it's such a snappy impulse. And then when it hits the rifling, I swear I can feel that thing torque sideways when the bullet hits the rifling to turn in there. So I'm not a fan because of that. I'm not a fan because of the amount of abuse it gives to the gun and the shooter. And I'm just not a fan of the jack-of-all-trades, master-of-none thought. The 45 is the big trucking around that stops. And that's what the 45 ACP was designed for when the Marines were in the Philippines. They found the 38 wasn't doing nothing for them, but the 45 long Colt would help them out. And the 32 ACP at the time that they were using out of other guns sure as heck wasn't doing anything. And even their rifles were punching through some of the Filipinos they were fighting at the time, but that 45 long Colt would put them down. So they wanted that gun. That's what the Army designed. And that's why John Browning, he designed, really, if you ever find him, the original, like, 1911 design was like the 1902 or 1903, and it was in 32 ACP, that little tiny cartridge. So John Browning thought that that was a good round. The Army said, no, we want that big 45. And so came alive the 45 ACP when they designed it. Kind of cool history there. But so the history of that is the 45 was designed to stop people. And if you look at the history of the 9mm, it was really came into vogue after World War I when they found that the Germans found fighting on the Eastern Front against the Russians is their little, I forget what they were shooting at the time. Whatever their gun was at the time would not penetrate the heavy clothing of the Russians were wearing. So I had a gun that wouldn't penetrate the guy's jacket that he was wearing every day. Kind of dumb. So they went out and then they kind of came up with the 9mm. And the 9mm was designed to penetrate that jacket and make the handgun actually work again for them. So you see where the things come in and all that stuff. And then the 40 was designed to be a cut down 10mm that would give you the best of the 45 and best of the 9mm. I kind of think it fails, but that's personal preference right there. So before you send hate mail, and you can if you want to, my email address is ben@modernselfprotection.com. That's ben@modernselfprotection.com. And if you hate something I'm saying here, go ahead and send it to me. If it's cool, we can have a cool discussion about it. And I reserve the right to be wrong. I am not a perfect being. But just personal preference, I think the 40 is not the way to go. And I generally, when I'm selling guns, I steer people to the 9mm or the 45, unless they really want the 40. If you really want a 40, go for it. If that's your gun of choice and it works for you and you shoot it well, by all means, keep shooting it. For me, the 9mm is just better. And I think it's a better all-around round and gun now that we have the improved ammunition. And I do honestly miss my 45 1911 just because it's a 45 1911. So anyways, that's kind of the history and thoughts around the 40 caliber Smith & Wesson. It is a good cartridge if you can handle the recoil and that you don't mind the gun beating you up a little bit and beating up the gun a little bit. You're good for it. Stay with it. If you like it, go for it. But you'll catch me with my 9mm or my 45 all the time.
Okay, as you could tell, that was meant to be a middle of the week podcast, but I didn't get around to it, got busy, so I put it in on this one. Thank you, Ben. Good stuff. I appreciate that. You know, 40 caliber is not really one of my favorite calibers either. I'm really kind of enamored by the 357 SIG, but I've had good luck just with 9mm guns, and the 9mm ammo out there is so good, and the capacity. I mean, the capacity of 9mm service size weapons, and even the compact 9mm. I love the capacity. I don't want to trade the capacity for a larger caliber. It's just not worth it to me, since the 9mm ammo is so good. And I don't think we're going to get stuck carrying ball ammo. I really don't. I think that good quality hollow points with excellent penetration and expansion are going to be around a while. For quite some time. And stock up on them. Okay, I don't think we're going to be stuck just carrying full metal jacket. I'll bet on the fact that we're not going to be stuck with that. So I feel pretty good. Feel pretty good with 16 rounds of 9mm in my Glock 19. I really do. Or 9 rounds in my M&P Shield. That's about as low as I want to go. The M&P Shield's been getting more carry time than my Car PM9 simply because of the extra capacity. Even if it's just an extra round or two, it's an extra round or two, and the gun's not that much bigger and harder to carry. So, you know, I like that. Well, I hope you got something out of this week. Keep the voicemails coming. I've already got a few more that I'm going to cover next week. So if I didn't get it covered this week, I'll probably cover them next week. With all this said, I'm Bob Main. Thanks for listening to another episode of your weekly Handgun World podcast. The reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a comp. Remember, the loudest sound a shooter hears is a bang when he's expecting a click, or a click when he's expecting a bang. Shoot straight, shoot safe. Catch you next week. Goodbye.